Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this October 16th. And it was 50 years ago this morning, actually, that Ted Sorensen received a call from President John Kennedy asking him to get to the White House for an important meeting. And an important meeting it was. It was the beginning of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the day when some are saying the time period when the world almost came to an end. PBS has done a fascinating documentary. It's an hour-long documentary that will air on Tuesday, October 23rd, titled Cuban Missile Crisis, Three Men Go to War, The Most Dangerous Days in the History of Mankind. And this hour, we're going to be interviewing two of the people who are featured prominently in that film. Michael Dobbs is joining us momentarily, the author of a comprehensive account of the Cuban Missile Crisis, 1 Minute to Midnight, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro on the Brink of Nuclear War. Michael is at the moment tweeting the Cuban Missile Crisis in real time for Foreign Policy magazine. And a little bit later this hour of the program, we'll speak with Brigadier General Gerald Eugene McElmoyle, who was a U-2 pilot who flew missions over Cuba. We're welcoming phone calls all hour. Here's how you reach our conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can always leave messages on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Michael Dobbs, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
So tell me about the phone call that Ted Sorensen received 50 years ago this morning.
Well, the more important thing is when the president himself found out about the presence of missiles in Cuba. They were discovered on October the 15th, yesterday, 50 years ago. We'd sent a U-2 plane over Cuba on the 14th, and the intelligence analysts concluded on the 15th that the Soviets had deployed nuclear missiles in Cuba, something that their leader at the time, Nikita Khrushchev, had promised that he wouldn't do. The analysts figured this out on the 15th, late at night, but they didn't wake the president up immediately. They decided the National Security Advisor, Mac Bundy, thought it would be better that the president got a good night's sleep. So the famous 3 a.m. moment, which there's been a lot of talk about that in the political campaign,
yes,
actually came at 8 a.m.
Oh my!
The following day, Monday, October 16th, 50 years ago today, which is when Mac Bundy walked into the president's bedroom and told him that the Soviets had sent nuclear missiles to Cuba that could reach most of the eastern half of the United States.
And not too much sleep for that administration for quite some time. Why did Khrushchev send nuclear missiles to Cuba? Did he ever say why?
He did in his memoirs, and he put the emphasis on the defense of the Cuban Revolution. He said that it was clear to him and to Castro that the Kennedy administration was out to overthrow Fidel Castro, and he wanted to defend the Castro regime. Castro had declared his revolution to be a socialist revolution and had appealed for Soviet protection. And for Khrushchev, this was a matter of ideology. Once a country had gone socialist or communist, there was no way back. Of course, he had other motivations as well. One was that the Soviet Union had many fewer nuclear missiles at the time than the United States. So by sending these nuclear missiles to Cuba, he could not exactly even the balance, but he could at least redress the balance to some extent. And finally, the United States had deployed nuclear missiles of a similar type to Turkey and Italy. So Khrushchev thought, well, the United States has surrounded the Soviet Union with nuclear missile bases. I'll give them a taste of their own medicine.
Mm-hmm. Did Khrushchev in some way think that he could get away with this because it was a relatively new and young and perhaps, he thought, inexperienced administration?
Perhaps there was a bit of that. He had met Kennedy the year before at Vienna for their one and only summit meeting. And he attempted to bully Kennedy at that time, and Kennedy concluded that Khrushchev thought he was weak and inexperienced, and he would have to do something to correct that misimpression. Khrushchev, in his memoirs, says he didn't underestimate Kennedy, but there's certainly a big gap between them in terms of age and experience. Khrushchev at one point said, "I'm old enough to be that man's father." So he probably did think he could push Kennedy around.
And what about the relationship between Castro and Khrushchev?
Well, Castro had come to power in Cuba in January 1959. And he didn't immediately say that he was a communist. But he declared that his revolution was a socialist revolution after the Bay of Pigs in 1961. So when that happened, the Soviets began to take a lot of interest in Cuba. And it kind of kindled their romantic feelings about revolutions. The Soviet Union's revolution was an aging revolution. And in Castro and the Cuban revolutionaries, they saw themselves 30, 40 years previously. In fact, one of Khrushchev's aides said, "These men are just like us, just like we were when we were young men."
Tell me about the people Kennedy brought to his side to get advice on this situation.
He formed an ad hoc group called the EXCOM, which was short for Executive Committee. And he brought together the people who he thought would be the most give him the best advice. It wasn't a formal group like the National Security Council. So he included his speechwriter, Ted Sorensen. But his key aides were really Bobby Kennedy, his brother, who was Attorney General, but was really Jack Kennedy's closest confidant and advisor. And also Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense. He had previously been head of a big motor company and had the reputation of being a sort of a technocrat, very smart man, non-ideological.
Mm-hmm. This movie is really fascinating to look at. Evidently, a whole lot of information has come out as a result of archives. I didn't realize that Fidel Castro thought that the process of the missiles coming to Cuba should have been done entirely in the open. And I'm wondering why Khrushchev didn't do it that way, why Castro wanted it done that way, and what would have happened if it had been done that way.
Well, that's a good point, and this was certainly a difference between Castro and Khrushchev. I think simply it was done that way because that's the way the Soviets operated. They like to do things in secret. And Khrushchev's idea was that they would present the Americans with a fait accompli. They would deploy these missiles in secret, prepare them. It took some weeks to get them ready to be fired at the United States. And he planned to come to Cuba in November 1962, after the midterm elections in the United States, and simply announced that he had concluded a defense treaty with Cuba and that these missiles were ready to fire. And at that point, there would have been practically nothing that the United States could have done about it, short of risking a nuclear war. But the deployment was discovered early in October. As to why the second part of your question was
why Castro wanted it to be so open, and it was all part of the same question.
Right. He wanted to defend. He thought the missiles were his best defense against an American invasion. Mm. So therefore, he thought, well, if this is my guarantee against being invaded, we should announce this right from the start and be public about it, as actually had happened between the United States and Turkey. The United States had sent similar missiles to Turkey right on Soviet Union's borders and had announced it in advance. Had Khrushchev done that, it would have posed Kennedy a very difficult problem because he'd done something very similar with Turkey. So it would have been difficult for him to object to the Russians concluding a similar agreement with Cuba.
Mm. And Turkey will get to, it turns out to be vitally important in reaching some kind of deal here. Was he getting pretty much across the board advice from his military advisors who wanted to blow Cuba to smithereens?
Well, I think everybody's advice and opinion in the first few hours of the crisis, when they found out what had happened on October the 16th, was that they had to take these missiles out by an airstrike, possibly followed up by an invasion. That was Kennedy's own first instinct. And he had a few days to think about it because he discovered this was secret intelligence. He didn't have to publicize it immediately. And the intelligence people told him that the missiles were still not ready to fire. So he thought about it and concluded that that was too dangerous, that they might not get all the missiles, and he would, instead of an airstrike, implement a naval quarantine around Cuba, or blockade, which was really a way to buy time for diplomatic negotiations. So at that point, the XCOM split. Half the XCOM was in favor of the blockade, and the other half wanted airstrikes followed by an invasion. The uniformed military, led by Curtis LeMay, the legendary Curtis LeMay, the head of the Strategic Air Command, were unanimously in favor of airstrikes, and they thought the president was very weak to go with this lesser option of a blockade. And in fact, there's some very revealing tapes in which LeMay accuses Kennedy of appeasement worse than the appeasement of the Nazis at Munich.
Hmm. When were those tapes released?
The tapes have been released over the last 20 years. We've had the transcripts of the XCOM meetings, which are an extraordinary, valuable insight into the president's decision-making. Mm-hmm.
And Michael, when did the American public become aware of what was going on?
As I said, there was a private phase of the crisis for the first 6 days, and then the president goes on television on October the 22nd when he's made his decision about the blockade and announces to the shocked American public that the Soviets have missiles in Cuba, and he's imposing a blockade, and they have to withdraw them. And that is the first time that Khrushchev and his colleagues in Moscow find out that the Americans are onto their secret.
That's the first time the Soviets find out.
Well, that's when they find out that the U.S. knows what they've been doing.
Huh. The other thing is, we have to remember, they didn't have, you know, email or anything, and some of the communication subsequently between the two countries would take hours and hours and hours, which was another element that made this whole situation terribly frightening.
That's correct. And this wasn't the Twitter age, and it was before the hotline. An interesting sidelight is that the Russians had suggested installing a hotline between Moscow and Washington in the summer of 1962, and Kennedy rejected that suggestion. He said, our communications are quite adequate. We don't need better communications. But that turned out to be wrong during the missile crisis, because then it took them about 10 to 12 hours to get a message from Washington to Moscow and vice versa. The messages had to be sent by Western Union. They had to be coded at one end, decoded at the other, translated. All that took about 12 hours. By the end of the crisis in particular, they didn't have 12 hours to spend trying to communicate with each other.
Mm. Shortly, and I'd like for you to set this up for us, and then we will take a little pause and we will meet him. The reconnaissance, we're going to speak with a brigadier general, a former U-2 pilot who flew high-level reconnaissance missions over Cuba. How many missions did we fly? What were we looking for? What did we find? And how dangerous was his job?
Well, General McAmul, who I understand is going to be your guest, may correct me, but I think there were 60, 70 missions in the course of October, November. Mm. The first mission was flown by a man called Richard Heiser on October the 14th, and he was joined later on by seven or eight other U-2 pilots, including General McAmul, flying these high-altitude missions over Cuba at about 60,000 feet, photographing much of the island, and they were out of range of normal anti-aircraft fire, but they could be hit by surface-to-air missile sites. The Soviets had ringed Cuba with SAM sites, and one of these SAM missiles had actually brought down a U-2 pilot over the Soviet Union just a couple of years before, mm-hmm. Gary Powers, in a very well-known incident. So there was a lot of risk flying these missions.
And we will meet a general who did fly those missions, and Michael will stay with us. Michael Dobbs is our guest this whole hour. We're marking the 50th anniversary of what began actually in the early morning hours yesterday when the Kennedy administration discovered that there were missiles in Cuba and thus began the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was incredibly frightening time in the history, really, of the planet. PBS broadcasting Cuban Missile Crisis, Three Men Go to War next week, and we are talking with two of the people who are featured in the film. Michael is the author of 1 Minute to Midnight, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro on the Brink of Nuclear War, and joining us in just a moment, a gentleman, U-2 pilot, who flew high-level reconnaissance missions over Cuba. We welcome your phone calls. I'm sure some of you were alive during that time. If you weren't alive, you may know some of this story, but you're learning a lot of the details this hour of the show. Our phone number, we'd love to hear, particularly from those of you who were alive, you may remember some of the air raid drills that took place during that time and how this country and the world was pretty tense. People didn't sleep a lot during those weeks. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and you can always leave a message for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A couple quick reminders for you tonight. We will be airing the second presidential debate. It will start at 8 o'clock tonight here on the Ideas Network. And tomorrow we have this huge event going on at the Pabst Theater in downtown Milwaukee. Joy Cardine is doing her full 3-hour program from there. I am doing 2 hours tomorrow, and it's just going to be a rip-roaring good time, a substantive time, as we look at so many different issues that are prominent in this election. We'll have panels, we'll have students, we'll have the county executive of Waukesha, the mayor of Milwaukee. We'll have people looking at the media response to the presidential campaign. And we're inviting you to be a part of our political discussion by being in the audience. It would be wonderful to have you there. It's from 6 a.m. Anytime you can drop by, 6 a.m. till 11 tomorrow at the Pabst Theater in downtown Milwaukee. We'd like to meet you. You can share a little bit of coffee and pastries with us tomorrow. Joy's show, 6 to 9, my show from 9 until 11. We would like to introduce a very brave man, Brigadier General Gerald Eugene McElmoyle, a U-2 pilot who did high-level reconnaissance missions over Cuba. Michael will continue with us. So, Michael, if you have questions for Brigadier General, feel free to do so. Brigadier General Gerald McElmoyle, thank you so much for being with us.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. And to bring us back. Yes.
Michael's already asked me all the questions.
But we didn't hear your answers.
Well, he was a big character in my book, 1 Minute to Midnight, a couple of years ago. And he's a great asset for people interested in the missile crisis.
Yes, I'm sure that he is. When did you discover, just tell me the first phone call that you received saying that you were going to have to do a reconnaissance mission over Cuba. How did that all take place?
Well, I just got home from a TDY on the 11th, and the wing commander arrived at my front door. I was a captain, and he says, be at base operations at 7 tonight. You're going someplace. And I said, where? And he said, you don't need to know yet. So we went out to North Base at Edwards to pick up the CIA airplanes. I don't know why President Kennedy made the decision, but he apparently wanted blue suit guys flying the missions over Cuba. The CIA had flown about a mission a month, starting the earliest one that I remember is August. I think they flew one in August, one in September. And they discovered the SA-2s there, I think, in August, because the September mission kind of went around the island, didn't overfly it. So the 11th is when I got called. I rode out to Edwards with a major general, and he told us the discussion had gone on in Washington, D.C. We were going to pick up the CIA U-2s. I'm not sure why. They flew a little bit iron arse because they had a bigger engine, the J-75, rather than what we had, the J-57. But Cuba was pretty much saturated with SA-2 sites. In other words, you couldn't fly over it almost any place without being in range of an SA-2 site.
So. And what's an SA-2?
Surface-to-air missile. It's the one that shot down Gary Powers over Sverdlovsk in Russia in May the 1st, 1960.
Mm-hmm.
And they were a little bit more sophisticated than shooting at Chinese. I'm not sure the Chinese were shooting them or the Russians, but as you very well know, the Russian general says he fired the ones that shot down Rudy Anderson on the 27th, but I'd been fired at by that same missile site on the 25th, so I was luckily, after I passed that, nuclear missile site that the Soviets were constructing, I'd made a turn to coast out, and I looked in my rearview mirror where their two SA-2s came up behind me, so they didn't get me.
No, they didn't. Here you are now. Thank goodness for that. Let's see, please, Michael, remind us of what happened. There was one of these American planes shot down. My goodness, there could have been retaliation for that right away, couldn't there?
Right. General McAmal was just referring to the incident on October 27th, Black Saturday, the peak of the crisis, when the Soviets did succeed in shooting down one of the U-2 planes flown by his colleague, Rudy Anderson. And that was taken by Kennedy as an escalation in Soviet actions and really marked the peak of the crisis. Actually, the same day, another U-2 flown by a man called Chuck Maltsby is quite a coincidence, but it got lost over the Soviet Union on the most dangerous day of the missile crisis. So there was a lot of action involving U-2 pilots during these 13 days.
Mm-hmm. Were you asked?
Well,
yes, I'm sorry, Jerry.
There's a statement by President Kennedy when Maltsby was discovered. He says there's always somebody doesn't get the word.
Mm-hmm.
But Chuck Maltsby was flying a different kind of mission. He was flying an air sampling mission up over the North Pole trying to collect the debris from nuclear atmospheric detonations. And he'd flown to the North Pole and was supposed to come back. But if you think about it, when you're at the North Pole and you turn to go back south to Eielson Air Force Base, which is where he had launched from, he had actually turned south. It took him towards Moscow. By the time he discovered that, he was over the Russian landmass. And, of course, they knew he was there, and there was some concern it might be a precursor to a launch by the United States. But
my goodness.
They were assured that it wasn't. Then you got to figure out whether they believed that or not. I don't know. Michael would probably give you a better view of that than I could.
Michael? Tell us. That was a dramatic incident as well.
Well, that illustrates really what can go wrong when two countries are gearing up for a nuclear war. And you know, sometimes the best laid plans come awry, and that was an example of it. I mean, what President Kennedy actually said was there's always some son of a bitch who doesn't get the word. So,
well, I try to be more polite.
That kind of reveals his frustration. But that was separate from what was taking place over Cuba. And
that's
the
true.
Cuban missions all flew as planned, with the exception of the Rudy Anderson mission, which was Rudy Anderson was shot down on October 27th.
Mm-hmm. General, were you asked to take pictures on those reconnaissance flights?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's all we were doing.
That was the point of the reconnaissance flight.
That's the whole point. We were taking the pictures and bringing them back. Steve Eisler flew the first mission on the 14th of October and brought the first pictures back. He landed in Orlando. They immediately took the film out of the camera and ran it to Washington, D.C., to the National Photo Interpretation Center, which was run by the CIA, and the pictures were delivered to the president.
Mm. And then to Adlai Stevenson, who delivered them in front of the United Nations. Tell us that story, Michael.
Well, on October the 25th, I think it was, Adlai Stevenson did go before the United Nations. The Russians were denying that any missiles were in Cuba. So we decided to produce the photographic evidence, which was collected mainly by the U-2 pilots, but there were also lower-level pilots later on who were flying their own missions
they
over Cuba.
They weren't the original.
But the first,
they went by the targets that we'd already found.
Right, the first evidence, it should be said, was collected by U-2 pilots like General McLemore. And that evidence produced, you know, that proved to Kennedy that Khrushchev had done something that he wasn't going to do. And Adlai Stevenson showed that evidence at the United Nations, which really clinched the argument with world public opinion that there were, in fact, Soviet missiles on Cuba, as the Kennedy administration claimed.
General McLemore, well, I'm sorry.
I don't think there's any doubt that the Russians knew we were flying the missions. We were painted with their radar every time we flew over the island. And we didn't get shot at, but you knew when they were picking up. I mean, our systems would show you exactly where the radar was, how far away, and what the azimuth was to the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew they were painting us. You know, they knew we were there, and I mean, the Russians had looked at U-2 since in the mid to late 50s over Russia, so they knew the signature.
You were in the military, so I'm sure that you go about this in a different way than most of us who were not. But were you afraid that this was perhaps the beginning of the end of everything? Did that thought cross your mind ever?
To be honest with you, it didn't, because quite frankly, I believe that President Kennedy was smarter than that. That's my personal belief, but not the Air Force policy or anything. I know that General LeMay was much more adamant about doing something, and quite frankly, I was only a captain. Got to remember that. But I thought that I just thought our president was smarter than that. I thought he'd rattling the sabers a little bit and getting Khrushchev's attention. I think that's what he was doing, and he did. And quite frankly, he made him back down. The final thing was Kennedy said he didn't trade off the missiles in Turkey for him, but, you know, he did, and I think that was smart. I don't understand why we even put him in there to start out with, but you're talking about a private citizen almost when you start getting into this area.
Yeah. Would you agree, was Kennedy smart in all of this, Michael?
Yeah, well, I think that the real risk didn't come from Kennedy and Khrushchev, who were intelligent men who certainly didn't want to unleash a new nuclear war. They'd been through World War II, and they knew that a nuclear war would be many times worse than this terrible war that both men had witnessed. I think the real risk of that we ran in October 1962 did not come from Kennedy and Khrushchev, but rather from, you know, a lot of accidents can happen when you ramp up when you start moving towards going to war. And we saw that in Cuba with the shoot down of Rudy Anderson. Khrushchev didn't know that the Soviet generals had shot him down until after the event. President Kennedy didn't know that this other U-2 pilot, Chuck Maltsby, had gone astray over the Soviet Union. They didn't know about confrontation in the Caribbean between the U.S. Navy and Soviet submarines armed with nuclear torpedoes. They didn't know that the U.S. administration didn't know until very late that the Soviets had also deployed tactical nuclear weapons on Cuba. So there were many things that could go wrong, and I think that was the real risk in October 1962, not the sanity of either Kennedy or Khrushchev.
Yeah. You know the ending, but you sit and watch this documentary, and I must tell you, I was just on the edge of my seat, all the possibilities of things that could go wrong. It scared the heck out of you. We have a ton of phone calls, gentlemen. Let's go to our audience. Scott in Rockton, Illinois, would like to speak with you. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. How are you all?
All right, Scott. How are you?
Hi. First, thanks to the general and all the military for their service to our country and protecting us during that time. I was a sixth grade student in New York City. During that period, I remember it quite well. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. She had five kids at the time. I remember us walking around after school with her to meet neighbors, and they're all being quite apprehensive about what was going to happen. As I recall, churches were absolutely packed during that time, and it was all kind of in anticipation of what might happen. Scary, scary time. I don't remember a lot of big changes at school. I think at PS30 on Staten Island, I think they tried to keep us calm, and there wasn't a big change in the normal routine or anything like that.
You didn't have to jump under your desk, do those drills?
Well, we normally did that anyway every so often as part of that era. That was part of the drill. But it was a scary time for us. I remember that, and mostly by absorption from the grown-ups at the time for the children. We could tell they were so frightened of what was going to happen. Very horrible. I remember getting a sense afterward, though. I don't know if anybody's touched on this. when all was said and done, that America had won a great victory in this, that we had stared down the Russians. They blinked, and they withdrew. And that was the impression in the media, I believe, at the time. And we had stood up to them, and they had stepped down. Afterwards, years later, months later, I remember reading that we, in turn, had taken missiles out of Turkey. So it was some behind-the-scenes dealing probably going on at the time. But not sure how the Russians allowed it to happen, that we got to celebrate it as a propaganda victory.
Well, that's an interesting part of the story. Michael, tell us that story.
You mean the spinning of the crisis afterwards?
Yeah, and how Khrushchev remained silent about all of this.
Right. Well, again, this is they weren't so public opinion for a Soviet leader is different than public opinion for an American leader, because this is a democracy and that was a dictatorship. So Khrushchev really had his audience was his fellow members of the Presidium, and he was able to tell them that he did get something from Kennedy. He got a guarantee of a non-invasion, that the U.S. would not invade Cuba, and he also got an informal secret promise that we would withdraw our nuclear missiles from Turkey. Now, on the question of who won, I was at an event on Sunday at the JFK Library in Boston, and Sergei Khrushchev, the son of the former Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, was there, and he said, well, it's ridiculous to think, did we win the United States? He's now a U.S. citizen. Or did we win the Soviet Union, his former homeland? We all won, meaning humanity won, and we survived this period. And I think that's a good way of looking at it.
Mm-hmm. He's a U.S. citizen now? How did that happen?
He moved to the United States. Actually, he's a professor at Brown University.
Is he really?
He's a dual citizen, I think, but he certainly lives in the United States.
Mm-hmm. A caller who could not stay on the line, General, this goes to you, wanted to know if any Wisconsin or Madison connection to this crisis. This person thought that the photos that you took may have been developed here. Do you know that?
May have been what?
May have been developed in Madison somewhere, the photos?
No, I don't think so. They were top secret, and everything came off of our airplane as soon as we landed, immediately transported to a T-39 that was sitting there, engines running. And as soon as the film was put on the airplane, why, it took off, and 2 hours later was at Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't I've heard other people say they developed the film. That's baloney for my money, because we didn't send it anyplace but NPIC in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. General McElmoyle, when were you able to breathe a sigh of relief?
Well, I guess on the 27th when they said it was all over, but when they shot Rudy down, it really didn't end me for me then. He was a friend, a compatriot in arms, and I'm going up to Greenville to a dedication of a park and an airplane to him here on the 27th, the 50th anniversary of his shoot down and his death, and they're having a memorial service. I'm going to say a couple words there.
Mm.
So from my perspective alone, I was devastated by Andy getting shot down, to tell you the truth, but we all knew the danger, so that's the way it was.
You continued to fly missions over Cuba after his shoot down, though, didn't you?
That's correct.
For how long?
I think, I'm trying to think, but for about the next 6 months.
Really?
Because I was still flying, missions over there, and I think in August of 63. I think that might have been my last mission. I'd have to look it up on my Form 5, but I recall that because our base was being transferred, the wing was being transferred to Tucson, and everybody had already left when I got back from flying missions over Cuba out of Shreveport, Louisiana. We'd moved the operation from Orlando to Shreveport. So.
Hmm. General McElmoyle, we want to thank you so much for joining us.
Could I say one more thing?
Of course.
The one guy called in New York City.
Yes.
I'd called my wife at that time when everything was going on, and I said I wanted to know how she's doing. She didn't know where I was or what I was doing.
Oh my!
And she says, "Well, we're afraid this thing is gonna." And we lived in a duplex. She says, "Peg can act next door. We're gonna chop down this partition between our two houses so we can help each other, and we're filling our bathtubs full of water so we have water to drink and other things. And we put Scott the masking tape on the windows so they don't shatter." And I said, "Patty, I don't think that the Russians have Del Rio on their target list." It doesn't sound like much to you.
Yes, it does.
But
yes,
her,
it does.
It greatly relieved her mind.
Yes. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you.
My pleasure. Take care.
Yeah, you too. And you can hear more of his comments. He's interviewed for the documentary Cuban Missile Crisis, Three Men Go to War. That's another part of that. The whole film is absorbing, but who was it who said in the film that he wasn't sure if he would see another sunset?
I think that was Robert McNamara, the defense secretary. This was on the most dangerous day of the crisis, October 27th, Black Saturday, the day that Rudy Anderson was shot down. They thought that was an escalation by Khrushchev, and on that day they found out that the Soviets had actually completed work on at least 5 of the 6 missile sites. They were ready to fire the United States. And he and a number of other people thought that there could easily be an escalation to nuclear war.
Hmm. Eugene in Viola is our next caller. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen. I had just started counting normal that fall in 62, and we started getting news of that. Everything just started getting scary. And what I remember the most is the troop movements to the southeast of Florida. They were just moving troops to Florida, and we just kept track of things. It was just plain scary. It was just a relief after about 13 or 14 days.
Michael.
Yeah, we were preparing an invasion of Cuba, which would have been similar to the D-Day landings in Normandy in 1944 during the war. It involved 100,000 to 120,000 troops. So the caller is quite correct that there was a massive movement of military equipment and personnel to Florida, which would have been the jumping-off point for this invasion.
Thank you, Eugene, for the call. Art in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Well, I'm wondering if you could relay a little bit about the Cuban perspective, not only the threat of another invasion after the Bay of Pigs, and, of course, since there were Soviet tactical weapons, an invasion probably would have meant a nuclear war if it had happened in that context, but also Operation Mongoose, where the U.S. was mounting terrorism against Cuba, and why Cuba accepted the missiles to begin with.
Well, ordinary Cubans were kind of naive about nuclear war. They armed themselves with machetes and hunting rifles and certainly didn't understand that their country would probably be wiped out in the case of a war with the United States. But you alluded to Operation Mongoose and the Soviet actions, the U.S. actions, rather, against Castro. Certainly the Cubans, particularly at the higher level, had reason to believe that the Kennedy administration wanted to evict Castro and shut down his regime. Operation Mongoose was a campaign of sabotage, covert action. They tried to blow things up. It wasn't actually very effective. There were CIA-trained saboteurs on the island, actually, during the missile crisis itself. They didn't have much success. But what they did do was that they thoroughly alarmed the Cuban leadership and their Soviet patrons, and that definitely was a factor in the Soviet decision to send nuclear weapons to Cuba. So to that extent, Kennedy does bear some responsibility for the crisis.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls momentarily. Michael Dobbs is with us. Michael is a journalist and author. His book, 1 Minute to Midnight, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro on the Brink of Nuclear War, has just been published. And he also is featured prominently in the PBS documentary, Cuban Missile Crisis, Three Men Go to War, which will air October 23rd. What day is that? Well, you know, you can look at a calendar. October 23rd, Rhonda will... Tuesday, thank you. Next Tuesday, the documentary will air. More phone calls momentarily. If you'd like to join us, thanks for the call, Art. A couple lines are now open. They have been filled, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Michael is tweeting the Cuban Missile Crisis in real time for Foreign Policy Magazine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, the Islamic scholar Tariq Ramadan will be joining us. I believe he's in Qatar. And he has a new book, Islam and the Arab Awakening. He will talk about the Arab Spring, the ongoing civil war in Syria. He'll talk about Libya, North Africa's first steps toward democracy, and all that's going on in many countries in the Middle East. He'll be with us, our number two of our program. Also want to note that Michael Dobbs' latest book, 6 Months in 1945, From World War to Cold War, hits bookshelves today. We'll have to book him for a discussion of that book. Get the book and then talk about it down the road in the not-too-distant future. Anne in Harbor Springs, Michigan, is our next caller. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I saw the documentary, 13 Days, in which they portray the Kennedy brothers as having a difference of opinion in their approach at some point. I can't remember if it was early on or not. But I wanted to know if your author, your guest, was familiar with that and how significant it might have been.
Yes, I think that there were some difference between Jack and Bobby Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy tended to be more aggressive and quicker to offend. He was the rough brother, and Jack Kennedy was the cool brother. But I think most of their differences were stylistic. I mean, in a way, they were two sides of the same person. And Bobby Kennedy was certainly Jack Kennedy's closest advisor during the missile crisis, the person that the president trusted to convey his messages. He sent Bobby Kennedy on the night of October 27th to the Soviet, to meet with the Soviet ambassador to Washington to hammer out a deal that actually ended the crisis. So he, although there may have been some differences, he trusted Bobby to carry out his wishes. And Bobby Kennedy, you know, he really wanted to do what is implement his brother's policy. He wasn't an independent actor.
I think maybe you can shed more light on this. I was watching something last night. I know HBO has a documentary on Ethel Kennedy that airs tomorrow night, and it was on the news last night. And there was a short snippet with her. Bobby Kennedy had all the children were in the living room or somewhere, and they were asked if they wanted to stay on the East Coast or if the whole family wanted to move to the West Coast. So I thought, what a dramatic thing to be asking all of your children during this time period, and they all agreed to stay on the East Coast.
Yeah, well, they were getting ready to in the White House to evacuate the White House, go to what they called the underground, i.e. a deep shelter somewhere in West Virginia or Pennsylvania. The president had sent Jackie and the kids off to the country on the Friday the 26th, I think. So actually the higher you up you were and the more information you had about what was happening in Cuba, the more alarmed you became. But it never quite came to that. It would have probably come to that over the weekend, but on the 28th, Sunday, Khrushchev announced he was withdrawing his missiles from Cuba, and that really ended that scare of high-level officials sending their families away.
Thanks for the call, and Will in Eau Claire. Hi, Will.
Good morning. I have a personal anecdote, and I was about 11 or 12 when the actual Cuban Missile Crisis occurred, but later on, about 9 years later in 1971, I was attending Ripon College here in Wisconsin, and one of Theodore Sorensen's sons was on my, we were on the same floor together at Ripon College, and one evening, Mr. Sorensen, Ted Sorensen, came to school to visit his son, and then later after dinner, he, you know, he gave a speech in the student union. When I was, you know, a kid, 11 or 12, I didn't really understand what happened, but I remember before dinner, four or five of us got together in his son's room, and we sat around, and Mr. Sorensen, Ted Sorensen, you know, just talked about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he said, you know, some of the stuff I can't talk about because it's classified, because I was only like 9 years after the actual crisis, but to hear it from him at that time just gave us goosebumps. You know, I didn't realize how serious it was and how close to, you know, this apocalyptic event we really were. But I just wanted to convey that, you know, 21-year-old kid sitting around listening to this man talk about it, our jaws were on the floor. So,
I'm sure, and that's what happens after you see this documentary, even if you lived through it. Was your jaw on the floor as well when you were documenting this period in history, Michael?
Well, I mean, finding out some of the details really sort of put the hairs up on my back. I think, as I say, what really struck me was what the president didn't know rather than what he did know. And there's the famous Watergate question, when did the president know and what did he know and when did he know it? And the real question during the missile crisis is what he didn't know, because neither he nor Khrushchev were fully in control of their own military machines, mm-hmm. which were moving forward under their own momentum. And many things were happening that neither leader could fully control, and that was the real risk.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. Will you please join us? We'll get a copy of your book. We'd love to talk to you about your 6 months in 1945 from World War to Cold War, which is just out today, I believe, right?
That's right. I'd love to come back and chat about it.
Please, Michael, we'd love to have you here. Thank you so much for being with us. It was such an informative hour. And look for Michael. He's featured in the Cuban Missile Crisis, Three Men Go to War. It's a documentary. I saw it last night, and it will air October 23rd on PBS. And I can tell there's a lot of interest in this topic. You'll want to see the documentary. Well, that was interesting, wasn't it? Whew. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who produced this program. Thanks for all of your calls. I want to remind you, the presidential debate is on tonight here on the Ideas Network. And tomorrow, please come and see us. Joy Cardine and I will both be broadcasting our shows full 5 hours tomorrow from 6 until 11. We're at the Pabst in that little pub thing that's right off Wells Street. We'll have a number of guests with us. The county executive of Waukesha will join us, the mayor of Milwaukee, who will be filling in for Governor Romney and for President Obama. We will have students with us who are highly interested in working for the various campaigns. We'll have a panel, an economist, a political scientist. Mike Goucher from Upfront with Mike Goucher will be with us. So drop on by. Plus, we have pastries and coffee. How can you not show up? See you then.